Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is William Gibson, whose latest book is Distrust That Particular Flavor, which is a collection of essays written over the course of the past 20-odd years. I think the oldest is from 1989 and the most recent from 2010. William Gibson is the author of several novels, including Zero History, Spook Country, Pattern Recognition, going all the way back to Neuromancer, in which the word cyberspace first came into being, though the cyberspace of Neuromancer is not quite the cyberspace of today. Let me start, William Gibson, by asking, what prompted you to put the book together?
I wish I could tell you something that sounded more high tone, but my publisher was sitting around with my literary agent one day lamenting the slowness with which I produced new novels. And he said, isn't there anything else we can do? And she said, oh, he's got this cardboard box under the desk with all of these like magazine articles and speeches and stuff. We could do a book of that. And to my surprise, the publisher got right on the case with that and said, yeah, that'll be great. So here we are. And I was, as one can tell, I think, from reading my introduction, a little bit ambivalent about doing it initially. But having it in print and touring it around, I'm not quite happy that we did it, because I didn't have any idea until I actually went back and reread all these things and tried to put them in some sort of more satisfying order, that they seem to be where a lot of my novels came from. So I've included little afterwards that say, well, this one is where the garage Kubrick filmmaker idea in my novel Pattern Recognition came from.
There's also, in one of the essays, I recall mention of the clothing elements of your last book is in one of them. And I'm looking and I'm going, oh, he must have gone back and reread this essay to even write.
I never did go back and reread them very much. But, you know, when I looked at them, I remembered what I had been thinking of at the time I wrote them. And I could see myself moving in particular directions.
Before we went on the air, I asked if you were working on anything now. And you said you're in those formative stages. At that point, when you're writing nonfiction, if you're writing nonfiction at that time, does that then trigger you toward your next book?
It's not that it triggers it so much as it bleeds into it. Whatever I'm most interested in when I'm in the process of getting a book together has a pretty good chance of winding up in the book, because I'm sort of like a junk sculptor more than, you know, someone who approaches a huge slab of marble and heroically takes away all the bits that don't look like David. So I have a much less heroic model of what I do, and it's more like welding a baby carriage on top of a steam engine or something.
Well, you said that a character or characters start grabbing you first before the idea that necessarily does.
Yeah.
And then the placement of the characters and the time frame. I mean, you've had two separate thematic trilogies, but now you're past the trilogies and you're looking at something else. So I guess it could be three books, it could be one. I mean,
I always assume, even with the ones that wound up being three book sets, I don't really think of them as trilogies, because in genre fiction, a trilogy is like one very long novel published in three volumes, and not very much happens in the middle volume. I always write novels as one-off things that you could read without having read any other associated works. I try to. But the position I'm in now, having closed off, I think, the previous three-book set, is I have to invent a whole new place in which to have a novel, and it may or may not be connected down the road to whatever the next novel is. I always kind of hope it won't be, because in my heart of hearts, I think I believe that novels are called that because they're supposed to be novels. And just, you know, whacking out, not that I whack out sequels, but it's harder work to do one-offs. Like if I could do 3 one-offs going forward from this, I'd be pretty happy.
Well, William Gibson, let's talk a little about this collection of essays. Where'd you get the title, Distrust That Particular Flavor?
It's a phrase from one of the pieces called Time Machine Cuba, which is a memoir of my childhood experience of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the particular flavor that experience caused me to distrust is the Chicken Little Sky is Falling Apocalypse Now brand of short-term futurism, which is something that futurists, be they science fiction writers or not, occasionally tend to get into. They often tend to get into it in late middle age when they realize that they're actually not getting any younger. And it's basically the after us, the deluge rant that, you know, nothing is as good as it used to be. The golden age is past. Things are just going to get worse until there's nothing at all left. Now, I know from a lifetime of reading old stuff, reading really old writing, that you can find people saying that from the very beginning of human literature. The classical Greeks were huge, but way before the classical Greeks, people are saying, yeah, you know, the age of the pyramid builders is past. Egypt is totally tits up now. Nothing any good is, you know, and pop music is bad. And I've been myself hearing that all my life. I heard lots of old people say that about us in the 60s. So basically, whenever I hear it, I don't believe it. But my first experience of not believing it was when I actually bought it that the world was going to end because of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and had a very traumatic time around that, and then it didn't end.
Well, if there's any thread through this book, it is, in fact, about the nature of futurism, science fiction, and how we view the future from our own perch.
Yeah.
The essays I found most fascinating, aside from the ones about Singapore and Tokyo, were the ones written in the 80s and 90s about the future of the internet and the web, and what you got right and what you got wrong. To some degree, it, you know, in a weird way, it reminds me of a 1930s movie called Just Imagine, which is about 1980 and flying cars.
Yeah.
You can't predict the future.
No, you can't predict it. And it's a kind of glitch in our culture that causes people to come to science fiction as though science fiction was some sort of fortune-telling operation.
You get cyberspace kind of, but of course, as you've said many times, you didn't get cell phones.
No. It's never bothered me. That's never bothered me at all, because when I began to write science fiction, I did so conscious of the fact that imaginary futures in fiction can only be about the day in which they were written, or time up until the day in which they were written. And the longer they last after they're written, the more evident it will be that they're actually about 1926 or 1948 or 1984. That's the only way you can read them. They just become old fiction, and they become quaint. If you do your job right as a science fiction writer, and rigorously extrapolate the moment you're writing in into an imaginary future, it will become quaint.
It becomes quaint, yet at the same time, Orwell's idea of newspeak, I mean, we see it even more now. Well, we've been seeing it a lot over the past 30 years.
I would say that it wasn't predictive. It was the result of his extremely keen observation of 1948, the year in which it was written, and the preceding decade. Like, newspeak is about what Orwell saw happening, say, between 38 and 48. He turned it up to 11, the way you do with that kind of science fiction. And it's really elegantly analyzed. And the way it's analyzed is the way it actually works. But it's the way it worked in Orwell's day. And that's why it's still with us. It's a sort of cultural quirk of ours that we look at that and go, whoa, Orwell, he was prescient. Well, I don't think he was prescient. I don't think he could have imagined reality television any more than I imagined cell phones. And if I had imagined cell phones, I would have had this terrible problem writing a novel depicting what cell phones would be like. I'd have this very strange novel where in 1984, where in effect nobody was ever alone, and they spent all their time on the phone. I don't think anyone ever in the history of science fiction tried to do that. Nobody ever tried to extrapolate, in effect, Dick Tracy's wrist radio and what a world of those things would be like. But it would have been incredibly disruptive to whatever narrative you were attempting to pull off. To have fully realized cellular telephony. People wouldn't have gone, damn, that's a cool thing. Look, they're all on the telephone all the time. That's not really what people go to that sort of story for.
You have to have story and characters, yeah. And suddenly you've got something else that's taken over.
Yeah, it would have required someone imagining fully realized cellular telephony and then finding some narrative way to make that technology symbolically meaningful within the story they were telling. Otherwise, it would have just been a weird distraction.
William Gibson, you did in Rocket Radio talk about the family media node and interactive television, both of which we kind of have now, not necessarily in the way you thought, but we kind of have that. And as you said in your afterword, you kind of didn't know what you were talking about at the time.
Yeah. I don't know very much about technology, but I like to watch. And I watch what people do with technology, and I watch what people sort of mythically invoke as the technology that they'd like to have in a decade or that they think they're going to be receiving in a decade. But even, you know, when I wrote that piece, there was, in fact, a family media node, because what had once been a television set that could only receive broadcast signals had started to metastasize and was attached to all these other gizmos and things that would allow you to play back video cassettes and things that would allow you to play primitive video games. I mean, there started to be more junk and more cables.
There are three different essays about Tokyo and one about Singapore. It struck me that you could have been a travel writer. Have you ever thought about that?
Well, I think most novelists of my bent, whatever it might be, could have been travel writers. But, yeah, I could see doing that. The thing is, I don't like to travel as much as a travel writer has to like. I enjoy it when I do it, but I don't do it a whole lot. And one thing I've noticed, one thing I've actually accepted, finally, is that I would rather go somewhere I've already been 10 times in the course of my life than go somewhere new. And the reason for that is that I've discovered that what works for me is to continually return to places that really, really fascinate me. And each time I do, the experience deepens. And I'm also afforded this something akin to the experience that a native of that place would have living there for 30 years. If you've been going to London for 30 years, you have a sense, you know how it's changed. Otherwise, if you know, people are kind of ticking off the list of where they'll go next, they never really get it. I loved London the first time I saw it when I was 21, but I didn't really start to get it until I was about 35 after numerous visits. I started to get it. Like, I started to know, have a really good idea of what it was like to live there just from observing friends who who lived there and how it impacted them, both as an artist and as someone who just likes to enjoy culture. That's what I'm drawn to. Like, I'd rather, you know, if somebody offered me a free ticket today, I'd just say, Tokyo, you know, take me to Tokyo. I haven't been since the earthquake. I want to check it out.
You're listening to an interview with William Gibson, whose collection of essays is titled Distrust That Particular Flavor. What strikes me in the essays on Singapore and Tokyo is, in some sense, even though you don't say it, you're walking into this futuristic world, but the real future may well be a place like Bangkok.
Yeah. I mean, the real future will be every place. The real future will be a place like Louisville, too. It's too easy to lapse into that kind of Sunday supplement speak. Tokyo really got a lot of that in the 80s. And sometimes now people say to me, like, why Tokyo? Why Tokyo? It's not happening anymore. You should be going to Beijing and Shanghai. They just don't move me the same way. They don't have the same weird, weird modern history that Tokyo has.
Singapore, have you gone back?
No, I never have.
Were you intrigued to go back and see what the changes were? Because that, you know, as you call it, Disneyland with the death penalty, which is a fairly accurate description of everyone I know who's gone there.
When I finished the piece, and I was about to turn it in, I sort of flipped through it, and I thought, have I been too harsh? You know, have I painted this government as more draconian and cruel and autocratic than it actually is? And I thought, well, I don't know, but the deadline is here, so I'll turn it in. Then when it came out, they banned the magazine. I thought, oh, okay, they proved my case. They didn't want people in Singapore to be able to read that article. And I don't know how long the ban lasted. I don't think it was very long. The people at Wired magazine were basically delighted. They called me up and said, this is far out. They banned us. We can't sell any magazines there. We'll get a lot of press for that.
There's a long piece about your obsession with watches, which, yeah, I guess you're over now.
That was kind of a voluntary pseudo-autism experiment, I think, in retrospect. I wanted to afford myself this, you know, free rein with an obsessive, geeky hobby that is basically the sort of thing that if you start telling anybody about it and they're not into it, you can see them start to fall asleep. I just kind of lucked into it. Like, I thought, I can do this. I find this stuff curiously interesting. What I didn't really understand quite as clearly was at the beginning was that it was really about the learning curve. Like, I didn't want to have a big pile of antique wristwatches. I wanted to experience a steep, pointless, and witheringly detailed learning curve, which I did, but I've now forgotten more about old watches than almost anyone will ever know. Like, I've literally forgotten it. Like, the expertise evaporated as soon as I was no longer playing the game.
It seemed in reading your afterword that you were a little unsure even about putting the essay into this book.
It did strike me as indulgent, personally indulgent. And I was also afraid that it would just put people to sleep. But it's turned out to have its admirers. Quite a few people have said to me, oh, the one about the watches, that's my favorite. So, you know, you never know. In the end, we erred on the side of variety, I suppose.
The Peace Filmless Festival, which talks about the garage, Kubrick, in an interesting way, predates the found footage films and YouTube.
Totally, yeah, and I'd forgotten until I reread that was where, not that the article is where the garage Kubrick came from, because I can no longer remember where that came from, but I was working on the beginning of pattern recognition when I wrote that article, and I knew that I was going to have a character who made I thought, large, complex pieces of cinema in a little room in his parents' basement or something. And I really wanted to explore that. And the version of that, if it is a version of that, that finally emerges in pattern recognition is like totally different.
But you nailed it. I mean, the entire idea that we can sit around, that anybody can sit around now and create an epic with the sufficient software.
Time and software and the will to do it. What we still don't have, if I understand this correctly, and I may not, my impression is that what we don't have is a distribution platform for that. I mean, you can put it on YouTube in sections. You can put it with somewhat more dignity, perhaps, on Vimeo in sections. You can put it out there, and it can stay there, and people who want to see it can see it. But you can't get that sense of event, public event, that we still associate with cinema. All that emotional stuff about going to see the new film and the feeling of your friends all over the world are having the same experience.
We sometimes get that with TV shows, you know, something like a Sopranos or more recently a Boardwalk Empire and True Blood. What is it, the old water cooler idea?
Yeah.
But you can't get that if something is just amorphously out there.
No, you can't. I think we still have enough of that water cooler desire in the people who would like to make cinema that they're going to be disappointed. Maybe there's another generation on the way that won't even have that.
William Gibson, speaking of the arts, what do you think of the controversies over PIPA and SOPA, the Internet Piracy Acts, which I guess from one frame are laws designed to stop the piracy of copyrighted material, and the other frame is that they're laws to stop free speech?
Or that they are laws badly designed to protect intellectual property from piracy, which would, if enacted, have a catastrophic effect on free expression. I think that's sort of closer. I think they're stupid, badly designed laws that should never, ever have been allowed to get as far as they've managed to get so far. I would be very happy if they went away and didn't come back, even though those two particular laws, I think, are going away now. The impetus behind them will come back, unfortunately. So that fight will have to be refought over and over. I'm not a disbeliever in certain concepts of intellectual property, and indeed certain concepts of intellectual property keep a roof over my head, and I don't actually forget that. But that said, I would be unable to come up with an idea for a workable anti-piracy law. And really, my approach to my own work being pirated, and it's pretty like every other reasonably well-known writer, you can get every word I ever published in a single BitTorrent for free 24 hours a day from about 1,000 different sites. One, I'm not sure that ever actually cost me anything. Two, it may have functioned as a kind of advertising that lesser-known writers simply can't afford, if you will. And three, my friend Cory Doctorow looks at that and says, well, that's a tax on fame. It's an inevitable tax on fame. If you weren't well-known, people wouldn't pirate you.
But I also remember the days when they were trying to stop people from taping music.
Music has been sort of the test case for this. And the interesting thing about music is you can see that there was a window between the advent of audio recording and the ability to mass produce audio recordings. And the window was a monopoly on the means of production. And as soon as the monopoly on the means of production was broken, first by audio tape, but really by the cassette tape, when it was broken, and it could never be restored. I watched that happen after I'd published a couple of books. Like every couple of years, I would get a package from some company that had built an e-reader. And these e-readers used to be the size of a paperback dictionary and almost twice as thick. I think they're all gone now, but for years I had like a pile of them in the closet. I couldn't give them away. I'd get them and I'd put the thing in and I'd look at it and it was stupid and I'd throw it in the closet, but I kept getting them. But they kind of haunted me because I thought if they ever get that together, if they ever make that thing skinny and pocket-sized and reasonably attractive to use and people can transfer digital files in, there goes the neighborhood. And so, you know, it didn't surprise me when that finally happened.
Not to predict the future, but what do you think is going to happen with it?
I think that print on paper and e-books will coexist. But I also think, and this is something that I seldom see addressed when people talk about this, that just ecologically speaking, the way we publish books is a disaster. The carbon footprint is hideously disproportionate to what's actually being delivered. Publishers print the books. They're really heavy. They ship them long distances to retail operations who, when they fail to sell them, ship them back to the publisher. That doesn't make any sense. And that alone, in a saner world, would bring about the end of publishing as we've known it. But what I think they would then go to, and what I hope we go to, is a much more evolved print on demand at the retail outlet technology, which we already have. We have these incredibly impressive but very expensive and still relatively rare machines that you stick a thumb drive in it with all the information for a book, and it will produce literally any kind of book with a beautiful binding, and it emerges hot from the other end of the machine an hour later. I think that's a really attractive model to keep the print book alive and viable.
But then there's also, to me, the most important part about a bookstore is the ability to browse.
The way that would work under my semi-imagined model would be that the publishers would require a retailer to print one copy of each thing that was going to be offered. They wouldn't be for sale until the end of the year, and then they'd be sold because they would be all, like, thumbed and stuff. These samples would be sold at a discount. So the store could have, like, 3,000 or 4,000 different volumes, but they'd only have one copy of each thing. And you could browse through, and if you wanted to buy it, you pay, and they make you one in the back room, and they bring you the book. And the output from good book machines today is indistinguishable from, you know, a really well-made hardcover novel. Or you can make your own coffee table books or anything. It's really an interesting technology.
Or, of course, you walk up and buy the book electronically and they transmit it right into your e-reader.
Yeah.
William Gibson, what do you think of the Occupy movement?
That's a big question. And this may already have happened. I'm waiting for it to not be tied to particular geographic points. I would have liked to see everybody in New York at a certain point just say, okay, we're deoccupying. We'll see you in springtime. We'll be back. Just like slide out rather than that whole, we're going to hold the plaza, because you can't hold the plaza. It's not that kind of war. So I'm waiting to see what happens when the weather's better and waiting to see if it comes back.
Well, from the vantage point of Vancouver, when you're looking at the Republican nominating process, what are you looking at?
Nobody knows what they're looking at when they're looking at that. That is some weird stuff going on there. I can't imagine what it would be like to be a sane Republican at this point. And surely there are some. I think I actually know a few myself. And it just must be a very strange experience. We had Occupy Vancouver. And on the very last day when they had gotten turfed out of their spot by the courthouse, they sort of made a trek across town to the traditionally more blue-collar and underclass East Vancouver, where they were going to set up in the Central Community Park, and they were met by a phalanx of residents who said, "No way, over our dead body. You know, we're the underclass here, and you're out of here." And they couldn't stay, and that was the end of it. that encounter wasn't publicized at all because it just didn't fit with anybody's narrative. It didn't even fit with the narrative of the right. I heard some of it on the radio because CBC had people there covering it, and it was an extraordinary moment.
That brings up the question of, you know, what happens to a piece of information if it doesn't fit anybody's narrative?
It just floats around until someone turns up with a narrative that it will fit.
The Republicans abandoned the internet piracy laws before the Democrats did on the grounds that they were going to take advantage of this, but it's a narrative that doesn't fit either. They jumped on a bandwagon that is primarily a leftist bandwagon.
My impression was that the impetus, the lobby, the heavily lobbied impetus for those pieces of legislation can't actually be seen to have emerged more strongly on one or the other ends of the spectrum. I mean, you could say, oh, well, these are big corporations, so they have more in common with the right. But Hollywood, the industry culture of Hollywood, is not a right-wing culture, and it doesn't vote that way. I actually think that what we're looking at is a different split. We're seeing a different split there. Calling it generational doesn't quite get it either. From what I saw, that some of the Republican legislators who stood up and said it was a bad law, I thought they actually made the point that it was a bad law. I'm sure that they also saw that there would be, you know, strategically, it right. would be to their advantage. But that's politics.
William Gibson, what is Agrippa, a Book of the Dead? It's on your website. It's a poem.
Yeah, it's a poem. It was, it's a long story. The short form is that one artist and one curator, both freelancers in New York, wanted to make what they call a piece work. They wanted to make 100 identical pieces of art. One of the things that they wanted each of these piece works to contain would be some sort of digitally recorded written narrative which would erase itself from its platform as it was read. And what we wound up with was a floppy disk. Seems kind of funny now. You put the floppy disk in your disk drive, push the button, and it scrolls the poem that I wrote. And as it scrolls, it's simultaneously erasing it off the disk. So if you read it, you lose it. And you can't check and read it just a little bit because it's not built that way. It'll only erase the whole thing. So they proposed that to me, and it seemed to me that they were talking about memory and loss, and they wanted a text about memory and loss. I took an old Kodak snapshot album of pictures that my father had taken when he was a very small boy in Virginia in the late 1920s. And the poem consists of a description of each of maybe 10 of those images where it's, you know, spent a long time trying to figure out what was actually depicted there. And it's such a foreign world and time to me that there was a lot to work with. But as it happened, it's now debatable as to whether or not they ever produced the piecework. I've seen a few of these things, but I've seen photographs of a few of them. I don't have one. They were quite expensive, like $1,000 or more. I don't know if they ever did it. I don't know if any of the floppy disks ever contained my text, but my text found its way onto the internet. And it started to mutate, and I noticed that because I'd Google it sometimes, and it was losing lines, and things were getting misspelled, and words were getting, so it was decaying. So I decided that I would take my original text and put it on my website, and that could be the gold standard for what the text of the mysterious Agrippa actually is. The only other thing I could think of to say is that it's the only poem I've ever written or published. My only foray into poetry.
William Gibson, now that Distrust That Particular Flavor is out, Is there enough material for another volume, or are you thinking of writing more nonfiction now?
There might be enough material for another volume if I included the stuff that I didn't think was actually good enough for the first volume. So that would probably not be a good idea. As for doing more, these things are like very occasional for me. If someone comes up with the right package and it fits sufficiently loosely, I might be willing to try to go and do it. But I can't imagine what it would be.
If you continue to have problems coming up with an idea here for your next book, then maybe a couple of short pieces would get you on the road.
That's true, but the thing that I'm still reluctant to accept is that whatever the direction the pieces took me would wind up being the direction the book went. I don't know why I'm still uneasy with that. There's some part of me that still holds on to our standard cultural idea of creativity, which is that the author has an idea and then implements it. And even though I know that that has so seldom really been my story, there's some very young part of me that still hangs on to that.
You've been listening to an interview with William Gibson, whose collection of essays is titled Distrust That Particular Flavor. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.